Technological advances and better organization have allowed the military to generate considerably more combat capability with the same, or in some cases, fewer numbers of weapon platforms. Let me describe a few examples. Where once the Air Force and Navy planned in terms of sorties per target, they now assign targets per sortie. As the chart indicates to my right, in 1982, and even during Operation Desert Storm, we were down around 175 aircraft per target, targets per day, I should say, and it took multiple aircraft to achieve a target. In Operation Iraqi Freedom, targets per day has gone up to 650, so it's gone up some three-plus times. As late as 1997, the aircraft from an aircraft carrier, as I say, could engage those targets, and the changes are dramatic. Here's an example from the Navy. In the past, the Navy maintained a rigid deployment schedule. Ships would deploy for 6 months, overlapping ships.
Shut the hell up, Rumsfeld. This nonsense about the sorties and other things that you have set up for Iraqi freedom. Now, this should make it clear where Rumsfeld and gang are coming from. This is not about creating a new society for the Iraqi people post-elections that will benefit them. This is about a continuous implementation of the empire's military force, will, and know-how to crush any element that gets in his way. Stop dreaming. The Iraqi forces, just like Che and Fidel up in the Sierra Mountains, are not going to vote their way to freedom. You know what time it is. Slave time. Check it out. Listening to 101.1 Santa Cruz, 106.7 Illinois, LUBER.com, the world, RadioCrawl.net, the universe, and check out the Slave Revolt blog for the news, MP3 files on slave shows, and a hell of a lot more. Tonight, we're going to go into a new segment that deals with the roar, so to speak, of a black cat. The words in his own terms of Huey Newton. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 104.1 Slave Revolt.
I noticed when I was in Africa traveling around, I noticed many Africans who were still colonized, still exploited, still oppressed. And one of the things all of them had in common was they seemed sad, they would discuss their sad plight, but they weren't ready to really do anything to change it. They seemed to be waiting on some miracle. But
the contrasting difference between them and what happened in Kenya, the Kikuyu got mad. They just didn't care what the consequences were. They knew they cared nothing about legality, morality, or anything. All they knew was that they were being oppressed unjustly, illegally, immorally. And because of this unjust, illegal, immoral oppression that they were suffering, they came to the conclusion that they would be within their rights to bring it to a halt by any means necessary. And they adopted those means.
I think that change will only come through struggle. And of course, as I pointed out and I recapitulate, that we don't want war, but if it's necessary for us to wipe war out with some strong tactics, we're prepared to do this.
The difference between being projected as an extremist or a monster is only depends upon who controls the projection. If you project your own image, then you are able to project the positive image. But when your enemy is your master, and when your enemy masters the press that's going to build, create this image and project it abroad, then naturally your enemy is going to project you in the image of a monster. Because a reporter was asking me a few moments ago to either confirm or deny the statement that the Times had mentioned, where I said we need a Mau Mau in the United States. I never would deny that. Why, we need more than a Mau Mau in the United States. I mean, actually, a person have a lot of nerve to ask me that. In a society, I'm deviating now because they put me off the track. I got to deviate. In a society where in 1964, three civil rights workers can be murdered in cold blood, and not the Mississippi government, the federal government can't do anything about it, I say we need a Mau Mau. When a Negro educator can be murdered in Georgia, and they know who murdered him, and the government can do nothing about it, I say we need a Mau Mau. And I'll be the first to join them. And a lot of people that you don't think go for it will line right up behind you.
You think the black people are ready for a full-scale revolution in America? At this time, it's a prelude to the revolution.
You know what time it is. We're about to go into a new segment called The Roar of a Black Cat. And it deals with cats who made a call to arms, meaning freedom, by any means. Often, black folks are systematically categorized for domestic consumption in a form of an edible and digestible product that is seasoned and texturized for white dominant sensibilities and taste abilities, for that matter. That's in part because if most Americans truly listened and tasted black folks under our own conditions, the pure soul of black folks, so to speak, many would drop dead. of a non-toxified, non-pre-cooked reality. Something sanitized America has never been able to truly do. But in the end, won't have a choice. Huey Newton, co-founder of the Black Panther Party, while in jail for defending his life and his people, basically he offed a little punk cop named Officer Frey. He's asked certain questions by an interviewee, and we're going to explore some of that. Huey, a black cat in his own terms and words. So first off, Huey is asked about white reactionaries. Are they using the threat of the Black Panther Party to wage a war on black people as a whole? So let's see how Huey deals with this. Check it out.
What they're putting themselves in for is quite a different thing, you see. In other words, as far as black people being slaughtered, we're slaughtered every day, and historically 50 million black people were killed on the Middle Passage alone, according to Melvin J. Herskovich. And this was an act of genocide, which is not talked about, and that the only thing people talk about is the plight of the Jews, where 6 million were killed. And when I state 50 million black people killed, just bring them to this country, no one understands this. But what I'm saying is that our real danger is not the Burchites or the Minutemen or some other fanatics. That our danger is really the people who wear the uniform of the establishment, dressed in the clothes of the military or the police department. They're strong enough to wipe us out. Not wipe us out. They're strong enough to inflict great harm upon the community. And this thing about the fanatics going around agitating, I don't think it will have a great consequence to the black community. The killing of little Bobby Hutton, my treasure, was a matter of attempting to wipe out the leadership of the Panther, along with getting rid of Eldridge Cleaver. Because of his book, Soul on Ice, that reveals many things about the corruption of the penal system. Not only the Black Panther Party, black people in general are in danger. As you would note, that in the community where the police ambushed the Panthers, that the police fired upon the community in general. They fired in people's homes where there might have been women and children. Matter of fact, I understand that a child was almost killed, and that it was a continuation of a traditional practice, not only of the Oakland Police Department, but the police throughout the country. And an immediate end will have to be put to this, and I think that what's happening now is that the Black Panther Party is merely speeding up time. As we know that whenever a man becomes frantic and strikes wildly, that he's becoming very weak. He's striking now everyone in the world, and we know that he won't be able to engage the whole colored world into a war, and also fight a civil war here with the revolutionary people of America.
Yeah, he certainly can't. And that, I think that that represents rough parallel of a revolutionary perspective to point out that the struggle for black liberation here is a component part of the struggle for socialism here, and simultaneously that that struggle is tied to the international struggle against the imperialists. So, I don't know, right there, homeboy is in there. I'd say I'd give him an A on that one right there. He's right straight up down the line, it seems to me. Trace?
What's kind of interesting is how if you look at some of the stuff that Huey was saying, how like when the Empire during the 60s was lashing out at a lot of entities that made it look military, from a military standpoint, it made it look on the outside bodacious. But if you examine it more astutely, you see that it's more frantic actions. That of a really weak empire responding in its most reactionary ways. So a lot of the stuff that was going on even then were given hints, as Huey picked up. Now, if you look at the situation going on in Iraq, in the instance, let's say the Fallujah incidents, where everyone knew that the major component of the insurgents had already left town. All Sam was basically going to do was pulverize a bunch of old folks and little kids who couldn't get out of town, thus inflaming the whole situation even more and exposing that they were abandoned. But they were so busy trying to portray the image and needing to portray an image of them being all the on the offensive that they went through this whole farce that only helped radicalize the whole situation. But that's in part because it was a they're in a vulnerable situation just in the Iraqi thing. And if you contextualize the whole thing that's going on, many of their irrational, in a sense, behavior is that of the whole industrial system under its financial market system in a collapse. They know that we're just about to hit the bell curve concerning energy, you know, the finite energy supply of oil, and that is going, that resource is going to be harder and harder to extract, meaning it's going to be more expensive to extract. And then areas where they are going to try to extract it out of, it's going to take more energy and more finance to produce it at a level that is going to be usable for the industrial societies. And since they've wasted basically like 30, 40 years, when they knew that this time was coming up, since they wasted that time, instead of, in other words, developing alternative energy systems, that's not the way capitalism works. The market industrial capitalist system works. They're not operating in a planned, rational type of way. They're looking at the next quarters, trying to dominate other people's, other competitors, other oil-based competitors, and all of that type of stuff. Meanwhile, this finite energy source is on the down. Thereby, you have a precarious situation where the industrial system as a whole is in major crisis just from an energy standpoint. It's in a major crisis. So this is causing the industrialists in the capitalist orders to respond more reactionary and put themselves in a more precarious situation to try to hang on to control of the particular system. Now, Huey also broke down the devastation of you know, the transatlantic slave trade and what that did. Now, you know, I'm going to have to throw this in there. The slave trade that preceded the transatlantic Christian-based European slave trade was equally devastating. the Arab Islamic Mideast slave trade. Millions, literally millions. You can go down the different centuries, and there's a lot of documentation on these particular periods and the regions that were devastated, the northern region, the eastern region. This is why you have basically a liquidation of many of the original inhabitants and an Arabicization of, you know, the northern region, similar to, like, look at it in the context of what's happened to North America, what's happened to, you know, large parts of Latin America, where you see it Europeanized. Well, within that same context, you've seen the African continent Arabicized in certain regions, and that was in part because of the slave trade and the development and expansion of that imperial order into reaches of Africa that had a devastating, incredibly devastating and destabilizing toll on the region within Africa. Now, Huey was also right to point out that, look, you know, while these kooks like the Klan and the Minutemen and all of that, they're a problem, especially because they help fuel reactionary and division within the working class as a whole. But keep your eye on Sam. You know, Sam is the one who's stirring all of this type of stuff up. And overnight, we could take care of these little punks and the Minutemen and all of that type of stuff. But if the state's still there, there's going to be problems. And that's why there still is problems. It wasn't some Klansmen who went over to Haiti and recently overthrew the government in Haiti. It was Sam and his imperial machine. Next, Huey is asked about how he became so committed to the cause of revolutionary struggle. So let's check out what the brother has to say. Take it from there. Dig this.
What made you take up such a tremendous, I would say, burden, because it's so tremendous, because how you give your life for it. So I would like you to explain to me.
Well, from a very early age, with my association with people who were politically inclined, so the first group was a black nationalist group. I was at the age of about 16 or 17. They sort of guided me into an awareness of the plight of black people in America and people of color all over the world. And from that age on, I've been involved with political movements. And that, of course, I've experienced racism. Just being black here in America, one will necessarily experience exploitation and be affected by racism. I started to handle the question and strive for a solution to it. And up until this time, I think with this awareness, one can become more and more sensitive. And as one realizes the magnitude of the plight, one understands that people cannot live under this system or any capitalistic system because it excludes most of the people, and just a very small circle enjoy the fruits of the labor of the many. So going working from this premise, that I found it necessary to pass this consciousness on to other people. And the black man in general, ever since he's been here in America, has strived towards his freedom. Denmark Vesey and Nasser Prophet Turner were men who were speaking of freedom.
So once again, it's kind of interesting, you know, where basically, you can see that Huey's development was part and parcel to his involvement. So when you hear people like Frederick Douglass in the past talk about the struggle as a whole, that there is no progress without struggle, that same thing can be applied on an individual level. Unless you engage you know, and struggle with your strengths, weaknesses on a personal level, you know, within the context of political, social, evolutionary type of issues, you can't progress as an individual. So when you see these boneheads, you know, in America, grown men constantly going on and on about steroids and baseball and how they're bad, how these athletes are bad role models, and their whole lives are based around watching grown men play sports. You know, Tiger Woods, and you know, and what he's doing, and what Ernie Els, and on and on and on. You can see how large segments of this society just stay stagnant because they're not dealing with anything real. Often they're bringing their prejudices with them on these issues and stayed locked in it because that's a milieu that will more or less tolerate that type of ignorant, you know, rhetoric and stuff. And they'll just be absorbed into a state of perpetual adolescence. But as Huey explained, you know, he first got associated with some black nationalist groups, you know, like when he was around 16 or 17. And from there, he got involved with political issues and movements. And he then saw his situation in a larger context. He started to develop. Now, what's interesting is that, you know, when you also check out some of the things that he's written, like essay that he wrote January 17th, 1969, he goes into what he calls the functional definition of politics. And here's a quick thing in part of what he says on that. That, quote, politics is war without bloodshed. War is politics with bloodshed. When the peaceful means of politics are exhausted and the people do not get what they want, politics is continued. Usually this ends up in physical conflict, which is called war and is also political. Black people are not free because we lack political power. Historically, black reconstruction failed after the Civil War because blacks had neither political nor military power. The masses of black people at the time, nevertheless, were very clear on the definition of political power. It is evident in the songs of the time. On the day of Jubilee, we'd have 40 acres and a mule and two mules. This was promised black people by the Freedmen's Bureau. And as far as the black masses were concerned, this was freedom. For the talented 10th, quote unquote, of blacks living during the latter 19th century, freedom was operative in more explicitly political arenas such as the electoral politics. Although many of these blacks were often better educated than most whites in the South, having received schooling in France, Canada, and England, early black elected officials lacked the influence necessary to empower blacks at large, and it was for this reason, amongst others, that Reconstruction failed. Now, the reason why I just go into that is that, you know, he's given his particular polemic, and there's much more detail about what went on in, you know, during the Reconstruction period and so on and so forth. And he goes into that himself. But what I'm saying is that usually the little image of Huey is this very narrow typecast, Negroes with guns, you know, that type of thing that fits right nicely to the diet that many people in this society like to gobble up.
I think our listeners should be aware that at this particular phase of his development, where this tape is coming from, when he was in prison in 1967, 68, in that period, Huey Newton was defending a revolutionary position consistently during this period. Now, with time, as many would-be revolutionaries before him, this was to change. But let's hear the rest of this.
Well, I mean, we're going through a particular, see, what often happens is that people love to go into the era of his, you know, decline, personal decline and all of that, and they love to always bring that up, thereby ignoring the essential part.
Right.
I'm somewhat suspicious when that type of stuff happens.
Right.
Next, Huey is asked, what is there about this system that breeds racism. So let's see what Huey has to say. Check it out.
What is there about this system that creates and breeds racism?
I think that racism is in this country starts out as a very historical thing. It was probably stimulated through the greed for profit. Of course, that black people were brought here in chains as slaves to for the wealth of the enslaver, who was the European. And the reasons for white people choosing black people from south of Sahara was probably because of some because of the twisted mind of the European. And I think this stands into the religious situation that the European was unfortunate for some reason and claimed one God or absolutism, what we call it. We worship one God, and this God was all good, absolutely good, all powerful. And this God, of course, didn't have the animal drive that the human being has. Because a European identified with this one God, then he was put in a situation of rejecting himself. Let me finish this. He rejected, for instance, his sex drive. If he did anything that deviated from the code of God, then he was automatically a witch or something subhuman. Then when he contacted the African, especially South of Sahara, where we had dualism, and our God had two or more heads, that you ran a situation where the African could accept himself as a human being, accept his sex drive, and he didn't have to project his humanism to anyone else. And the European projected all of this evilness that he himself had to our so-called evilness, really was just human drive, to the African. And so it was a combination, what I'm attempting to explain, of not only economic exploitation but also racism. And then coming to this country, because it was so profitable for the European or the American in this case to work the slave, that racism became ingrained, and many white people don't understand it now.
All right, now there's many issues on this, but first let me just start off with slavery. Slavery is an institution that benefits a certain class economically. So once that particular class is developed, established, or expanded, there, of course, is going to be, in part, a form of rationalization that takes place. Now, if you look at how this is taking place in the context of this history from a historical fashion and how black contributions to world development have been downplayed, it becomes apparent. Let's take on the eve of Egyptology. Count Vonnegut, a Frenchman who was in Egypt at the time, in looking at the temples, the pyramids, the Sphinx, things like that, they realized that the Negro civilization, as Egypt was often referred to then, because it was just the thing of, black people just had this particular civilization, you know, which was right next to Nubia, which they knew was a very developed civilization with writing, science, art, mathematics, philosophies, building structures, et cetera, et cetera. So it wasn't too much of a shock. But what ended up happening was, as Egyptology started to develop, they realized that the Egyptian civilization was developed before the European civilizations. And that presented a problem, because as Count Vonnegut noted, that imagine this, the same people that we now hold in scorn and as our slaves were the very same people who gave us art, science, concepts of religion, etc., etc. Now, the problem with that was that at the same time, slavery was still going on in the Americas. And the ruling class had developed this a concept that black people were the white people's burden, the white man's burden, and they were doing us a favor. But if all of a sudden you're having a scientific objectivity established, something that throws that on its head, and that know that black people were not the quote-unquote inferior breed, then it becomes hard to justify what you're doing to those people. So the since American slave trade was based off of a financial motivation by the ruling class, the history, the sound history that was developing had to be overthrown. That model had to be overthrown, and that's how you started to have the Europeanization of Egypt and any other contribution that black people anywhere throughout the world had established. So it's similar in the sense of this dehumanization process of how the British would refer to Irish people and how they would act like Irish people were lower on the totem pole of human advancement than they, the Brits, and stuff. This was to justify their a domination over the Irish people. The fact that they were basically one and the same, you know, didn't really matter to them because there was an economic motivation to create this pseudoscience to justify the ruling elites that were making a profit off of that. You can put that in the same context of what is going on with the little neo-capitalist ruling class in Sudan right now, and how they're justifying the slaughter of the indigenous natives with their Arabic / Islamic version of superiority and stuff. And this also within Islam has a historical presence. You know, after like the Zanj had their slave revolt in the modern day Baghdad right now. You know, Zanj were the black slaves who were taken there by the Arab Islamic slavers. And there was a major slave revolt in what is now called the region of Baghdad, Iraq. And there's many descendants still left over there today, this black folks in Iraq. But you started to have pseudo-scientific descriptions by the Islam scholars, so on and so forth, that's very similar to the European capitalists in America and elsewhere depicting black people as an inferior breed. So take the Islamicist, this Arab named Sayyid al-Andalusia. He wrote that about black people, that because of the area that we live, living under the presence of the sun at its zenith, that, quote, their temperaments become hot and their humor fiery, their color black and their hair woolly. Now, as a consequence to this, he also says, quote, they lack self-control and steadiness of mind and are overcome by fickleness, foolishness, and ignorance. Such are the blacks who live in the extremity of the lands of Ethiopia, the Nubians, the Zanj, and the like, unquote. So here is this Arab who is coming to many of the core cradles of world civilization, the Nile Valley, Nubia, Ethiopia, all that whole region was in development and had developed before there was a Christianity, Islam, or Judaism. But as fate had it, or as things turned out, and the conquerors with the sword and the Quran in this region got, during this period, the stronghold, those elites and their pseudo-scientific and scholars started to rationalize the domination and decimation of these people who had civilizations before their little holy Islam even existed. But this is how things are rationalized when a monetary concept and things like that are put into place.
Yes, indeed. So how does this system breed racism? Or ideologically, when you start talking about ideologies of dead knowledge, we create racism generation after generation. This requires what I call a materialist analysis. A materialist analysis of racial exploitation or racial oppression. Racism requires, in order to be successfully carried out, and it requires a disguise, because most people abhor mistreating other human beings. In a world in which the Europeans were proclaiming freedom, equality, fraternity to the whole world following the French Revolution, these proclamations were not consistent with the subhuman treatment of black slaves, as Tracy has pointed out. Thus, racism was indeed born of necessity. And today, it also is quite important, and people need to understand this is not only an opinion game, but racism, as it does today and as it did under slavery, divided and divides the people along color lines, which prevents the working masses of all colors from uniting and effectively fighting back against the ruling class. Thus, white supremacy, as irrational as it is, prevents the American people from becoming a whole people, from becoming themselves.
Now next, Huey is asked about his relationship with his white lawyer and how this relationship seems to be so genuine and sincere, and they both have obviously so much respect. So he then questions Huey on the Black Panther Party's position on racism. So let's check out what Huey has to say. Dig this.
Let me say this. I have watched a beautiful relationship between you and Gary. It worked beautifully. And when people talking about Black Panther and racism, the relationship here between you and your lawyer, who is white, I haven't seen any in this case. What makes the difference here?
Well, if you were familiar with Panthers in general, you wouldn't see any racism either. That we're not racist. We believe that the solution to the problem here in America is not the goal is not racism, but the goal is freedom. And that the Black Panther Party is willing to work with any revolutionary people, and that it's not a color thing, that the Black Panther Party, black people in general, I believe the bulk of us are colorblind, that it's a matter of freedom, a matter of being free from the exploiter, nothing more, nothing less. The Black Panther Party is first a political party, and that we've analyzed the political situation here in America, and we see that black people are colonized people, and that we have to, if we're going to find an answer for our problem, the problem of liberation, that black people are in a state of slavery, and we must be liberated from the mother country. And the first step that we'll have to take towards liberation is control of our community. If we have no control of the destiny of the institutions within our community, then we have no guarantee of any other political right. And as we analyze history, we see that according to some historians, John O. Franklin, for one, and also E.B. Dubois, says that the reason that black reconstruction failed was because of lack of political, economical, and military power. And so the Black Panther Party is attempting to develop this political power. And one of the chief things that happened after the Civil War with the disarmament of black people by Lincoln. And Lincoln made certain statements to the effect that he didn't want black people to form guerrilla groups so that they could get true liberation. So this is why he disarmed them. We were promised land, which was never given by the Free Lands Bureau, 40 acres and 2 mules, according to Du Bois. All we got after the Emancipation Proclamation and black reconstruction was some black representatives and in the government. What was peculiar about these black politicians was that, in fact, they didn't represent a power force. Usually in the political arena, a political representative represents a power group, whether it's economical power or feudal power, commonly called land power, or even a military might. We noticed that if one cannot protect his land, then he doesn't really have control of it. We noticed that this government, after it makes a political decision, it always has its force to back up that political decision, and in the dress of the military or their police force.
So what you're doing is forming a political program then?
Yes, we do have a political program.
All right, once again, you know, Huey goes into a number of subjects. But one that's somewhat interesting is the issue that in certain levels can be applied to what's going on today. When he talked about, you know, many of the black representatives during Reconstruction really didn't have any kind of economic power, military power, you know, independent military power. In other words, not relying on the North or anything like that, or overall political power. So in a sense, you can become a figurehead in that type of situation or extremely vulnerable. And as the Reconstruction was destroyed, that kind of bore itself out in many ways. Now, if you look in today's terms, what you often see, though, are many liberals, progressives, pacifists, Democrats still trying to harangue us to get into this electoral process, and that black figureheads represent an advancement towards black people. But what does many of these overall black representatives in electoral position really represent? What do people like Condoleezza Rice represent? Do they represent a genuine economic independent base for the working class masses? No, they're servants to the ruling class. They go under the Democrat or Republican banner. They serve those parties' interests. They serve and follow within that economic order. And things are played out within that economic, political, social structure. So in the same way that you see historically the vulnerability of attaching too much credence to any kind of advancement to a working class struggle or black people's struggle from a historical standpoint, it also applies today. And in a sense, it applies if you address it to what's going on or attempted to be going on in Iraq right now. All of a sudden, Chalabi, of all persons, has popped up again and stands a good chance of holding political power. Now, this is someone who's obviously abandoned. This is someone who's obviously locked within the sphere of the imperial economic order. This is not someone who is going to truly represent the Iraqi people and the masses as a whole. He's down for the whole economic order as described by the whole market, World Bank, financial capitalist system. He himself is a marketeer. So the fact that someone like Chalabi or some of these other you know, handkerchief head Iraqis, where a hold a particular office is in a sense a farce, because what Sam is trying to do in part is, since they're basically getting their ass kicked militarily, they're trying to shape shift things and say, no, it's not about the insurgent struggle that's going on between us and the forces that are trying to physically throw us out. We're trying to give the Iraqi people their freedom through this electoral process. And anyone who criticizes the electoral process doesn't really stand for freedom, even though we're setting the conditions. We changed the monetary system of how Iraqi people are going to trade their own oil in. We are privatizing up the economy and debiting it out to basically us, the corporate elite establishment. We're the ones who are setting terms about who can and who can't run, etc., etc. We decide when they're going to have an election. Now, put this in the same context of Vietnam. If Sam, all of a sudden, in 1971, when things were obviously going astray, said, we're going to have an election in North Vietnam, and we're going to let the peasants and the people come and vote and decide what they're going to do. Now, here are their candidates and so on and so forth. It's the middle of a war. So anyone who got harmed, any peasants and, you know, the masses of people who got harmed within the middle of a war, that would be on the imperialist back for employing this ploy. They're using these electoral processes to control and hypnotize the masses. These are gangsters using these tools to have you think that you're making quote-unquote progress, when at the end of the day, it comes down to us seizing control of the resources, of the means of production, of the land. We have to be the expropriator. We have to call the shots, not let them set the terms of how society goes. Now, that goes, that holds true for the struggle that happened after the Civil War in the Reconstruction period, of what needed to take place, i.e. another civil war. That holds true. What's going on now currently within the working class masses in this country, it holds true in part of what's going on in Iraq.
Yes, sir. Now, while it's pretty clear, in my opinion, that this interview was conducted at a time when Huey Newton was indeed subjectively a revolutionary, that does not place him above all criticism, because I would not go along with that, with the use of the term colorblind to describe the way that black people feel about, you know, attacking capitalism. Although he is not far from the truth. No, not colorblind, but Huey is basically right that blacks, insofar as we became political in the 60s and the 70s, most blacks understood we could not win a revolution by ourselves, that we would have to have allies in order to bring about the big change. A successful revolution required the participation of white workers, students, and others. So, you know, it might just be a rhetorical flick, but I think more correctly framed, what should be said in that? Do we want people to be colorblind? No, we don't. We want everybody, in fact, to see clearly the role that color had played historically in terms of its manipulation by the ruling class. Why? So that the white workers can understand what has prevented them from coming to class consciousness. It is only by understanding the material basis of racism, of white supremacy, that white workers can transcend it and bring it in with the help of their black brothers and sisters to this dastardly system for once and for all. The other thing is, we used to have a thing in the Panthers where we used to talk about power. Power is, you know, the barrel of the gun, right? Well, there is another way of looking at power also. Power is based on the ownership and the control of the means of production. And here is a weakness of the Panthers in terms of our program. We did not see the working class as the primary actor in the struggle for the liberation of humanity. See, we saw it as a military matter. That when the people decide, we just use our weapons and then wham, they ain't got a chance. How you, 250 million people against a million? No, we got it. All we need to do is achieve the consciousness. Well, actually, you're never going to get 100% in terms of those who agree with the need for a social revolution. But what will make the decisive difference so that a successful revolution is possible is when the majority of the working class comes to the opinion that it's socialism or barbarism. That either a socialist revolution is made or we're going to see the end of humanity as we know it. At that point, we can make a socialist revolution, and we will.
In part, when the interviewer asked Huey the question about, you guys are, in the Black Panther Party, and but I see you working very well with this lawyer. How does that, what makes a difference between you and your lawyer's relationship and how you see things? And so Huey basically was responding to that, saying that, look, this lawyer, Gary something.
Charles Gary.
Yeah, Charles Gary. He respects us. He looks at us as human, So we have respect for him. So within that context, it's not really a color problem.
Right.
And so then Huey put it in the context that, in general, if black people were approached in that way, then they are more or less, in a sense, colorblind. As to say that, okay, we're not looking at it as someone that we have to have our full arm guard about because of how they, project themselves. Now, within that context, Huey also started to address other issues as time went on that give you a flavor of his developing political position. So in August 15th, 1970, he wrote an essay called The Women's Liberation and Gay Liberation Movements. And this is what he has to say, a small snippet on this. Quote, during the past few years, strong movements have developed among women and among homosexuals seeking their liberation. There has been some uncertainty about how to relate to these movements. Whatever your personal opinions and your insecurities about homosexuality and the various liberation movements amongst homosexuals and women, and I speak of homosexuals and women as an oppressed group, we should try to unite with them in a revolutionary fashion. I say, quote, whatever your insecurities are, unquote, because as you very well know, sometimes our first instinct is to want to hit a homosexual in the mouth and want a woman to be quiet. We want to hit a homosexual in the mouth because we are afraid we might be homosexuals, and we want to hit the woman or shut her up because we are afraid that she might castrate us or take the nuts we might not have to start with. We must gain security in ourselves and therefore have respect and feelings for all oppressed people. We must not use the racist attitude that the white races use against our people because they are black and poor. Many times the poorest white person is the most racist because he is afraid that he might lose something or discover something that he does not have. So you're some kind of threat to him. This kind of psychology is in operation when we view oppressed people and we are angry with them because of their particular kind of behavior or their particular kind of deviation from the established norm. Remember, we have not established a revolutionary value system. We are only in the process of establishing it. I do not remember are ever constituting any value that said that a revolutionary must say offensive things towards homosexuals or that a revolutionary should make sure that women do not speak out about their own particular kind of oppression. As a matter of fact, it is just the opposite. We say that we recognize the woman's right to be free. We have not said much about the homosexual at all, but we must relate to the homosexual movement because it is a real thing. And as I know through reading and through my life experience and observations, that homosexuals are not given freedom and liberty by anyone in this society. So there you see once again who you're dealing with, the issue of women and homosexual issues that are really outside of the box of the type of typical typecast that Huey and Black Panthers and Black people in general are looked upon as far as addressing these types of issues. But next, let's go on and deal with how Huey speaks about the responsibility of change. So let's check out what he has to say. Dig this.
One thing that I would like to say to the revolutionary youth throughout this country and throughout the world, that the responsibility for the change is upon our shoulders. The older generation has proven that they have either been disinterested or unable to change the institutions that have caused murder throughout the world, and America being the monster, and is the head of the monster to create the disturbance all over the world. So it's going to be our job to revolutionize the world. As far as we're concerned, that we're advocates of the abolition of war. We do not want war, but war can only be abolished through war. And in order to get rid of the gun, we found it necessary to take up the gun. That's from Chairman Mao, and I think that most revolutionaries agree with this throughout the world. I think that change will only come through struggle. And of course, as I pointed out, and I recapitulate, that we don't want war, but if it's necessary for us to wipe war out with some strong tactics, we're prepared to do this.
So once again, you see how Huey's examination of the warlike empire that is capitalism, and how he saw what is necessary for us to struggle through this. Now, also to show you the give you an idea of some of the issues that he took on and tried to connect to the capitalist system. In 1974, he also wrote an essay called The Dialectics of Nature. And here's a little snippet of what he had to say about that. The revolutionary dialectical materialist or intercommunalist perceives both the problems and solution of environmental disasters differently from the establishment of Western scientific reformers. Where the establishment sees individual human nature and technology and technological progress as the engine of destruction, the dialectical materialist looks on the ecological spoilation and traces the poisonous spore back to the strongholds of reaction and capital, calls the pollution for what it is, war against nature, against people, against the race itself, against the unborn. In his book, The Frail Ocean, Wesley Marx supplies us with a particularly ugly model of pollution to the resource-poor Anglo-American empire. The following is meant to symbolize the total confusion of responsibility and solution to what is, in reality, a complex ecological crisis that has become a function of the super-industrialist West. No other natural phenomenon on this planet, not even mountains 5 miles high, rivers spilling over cliffs, or redwood forests, evokes such reverence as the sea. Yet this same all-powerful, quote-unquote, ocean now proves as slavishly subservient to natural laws as a moth caught by candlelight or a rose seed blown into the Atlantic. The ocean obeys its heaves. It complies. It has its tolerances and its stresses. When these are surpassed, the ocean falters. Fish stocks can be depleted. The nurseries of marine life can be buried. Beaches can erode away. Seawater, the most common substance on this planet and the most life-nourishing, can be hideously corrupted. It can host substances that in the stomachs of oysters or clams are refined into poisonous that paralyze porpoises and man alike. Or as it became appallingly clear in March 18, 1967, an entire ocean region can suddenly find itself in direct jeopardy. The Atlantic Ocean off the southern tip of Great Britain sparkled deep blue, unsullied by running white caps or shadowing storm clouds, gallimaufs, amucks, red shanks, herons, and Penzance fishermen dipped into the blue world drawing sucker for its life-giving energy. At Land's End, hotel owners ordered new carpets to greet London's annual summer pilgrimage to the Cornish coast. Since the sapping of its tin mines and fertile lands, the magnet of ocean beaches alone keeps Cornwall from sinking into economic depression. Characteristically, Mark passes over the tin and land depletions. This is an example of one-dimensional analysis and fatal to the solution. This is just a small snippet, but what basically Huey goes into is how the ocean was obviously in peril in 1974, and he was tracing it back to the industrial market engine of the capitalist empires and the capitalist system as a whole. Now, let's blast up to 2005, and we know how serious and how Cassandra-like that polemic was. Now, the major fish stocks of the world's oceans, you know, bluefin tuna and all of that, have been reduced by 90% of their stock. Only 10% of the major fish stocks remain. This is because of the industrial engine of capitalism that knows no respect for any life forms on the planet. It only knows economic advancement, takeover, and carnage in its wake. We have a massive pollution of the ocean. Mothers-to-be are told to stay away from eating tuna because of the high content of mercury in the fish. That is a result of the whole economic market order. The whole world is in a state of chaos because of the way this whole economic order has gone on for so long. So once again, this gives you an idea of many of the things that Huey was trying to deal with in a revolutionary fashion that goes outside of the bounds of how Huey the Panthers and black people in general are often portrayed.
Yeah, I'd have to give Huey credit on this question with the environment, because he was talking about it long before most black leaders seriously wanted to deal with this. Of course, we know Marvin Gaye has that beautiful song on his album, but that's a cultural expression. In the political movement, you did not hear a lot of black nationalists or even civil rights leaders specifically address the environment that much. Nevertheless, I do want to take on this very serious weakness that's in the earlier statement when he was talking about, you know, the young people. You got to understand, the Panthers was a youth movement, first of all. Average Panther is probably somewhere like between 17 and 19. That's the average. The Panther was a youth movement. The Panther, in fact, revolutions in general, always reach and inspire the youth first. But here's where you have to be careful. Back in the 60s, we had a false consciousness, I would call it, called youth vanguardism. And that was expressed in Huey's statement when he says the older generation has shown indifference or basically incompetence in dealing with the oppressive system. That's quite true. Generally, you know, one could make that statement. But in fact, the revolution is not possible unless the older generation is eventually won over, at least to a passive stand where they don't oppose it, you see? So you can't, it's not like young people gonna say, well, we just gonna do this later for y'all. Yo, it's like that, you know? Nah, that don't work. Eventually, Of course, while the youth is the spark, the entire working class must come over to the concept of social revolution if it is to succeed. Youth vanguardism is a fatal error.
Next, Huey outlines the situation in the 60s for black people. So let's see how he addresses that. Check it out.
Here in America, we see that in the colonies, the black people are poor. They own no vested interest really in the industry. And what happens is our political representatives in the past have been only pawns for their white political colleagues who do have power. And they depend upon these political colleagues to keep them in office, and they depend upon their political colleagues to justify their actions. The Black Panther Party says that because we don't have these other things as far as economically, then we must develop still a power base. Historically, when revolts occur, there's the indication that something is going to happen, and that it seems to be a prelude to the actual revolution where things will be changed. So I think we're moving towards this revolution. There are some alternatives, and the only alternative would be to first withdraw the troops from our many black communities, and secondly, that we demand control of the institutions within our community. These are first steps. So it's clear in my mind through the current events that black people are thinking in these terms, even though most people are not very articulate, that you always have the articulate minority. And the job of this articulate minority is to express the desires in some coherent fashion of the majority of the people.
All right, so once again, you have Huey outlining some of his particular positions, and you know, a lot of that type of stuff was current of the time, you know, when many of them thought that they were moving towards revolution.
That's right.
Because of the particular atmosphere, and a lot of it was more of a cultural type of upheavals and stuff like that. Now, of course, it was combined with America being entrapped and ensnared in its own imperialist war in Vietnam, the draft going on and things like that. But many of the cultural aesthetics where people were thrusting off some of the conservative norms, you know, hairstyle and things of that nature, would appear seems to have given the impression of something being much more vibrant overall against the structure of the economic order. One finds that Huey himself assessed many of these issues later on and realized that many of these things were overstated. And if you just, in part, the reason why I'm reading some of these things in his own words is because to encourage people, if interested, to just kind of read some of the stuff that him or Malcolm, in their own words, say. And you'll see that he would had adjusted later on, you know, on the youth vanguard issue, on the issue of were they really moving towards quote unquote revolution in the 60s, and what was the material misunderstanding of that particular time being for many of them and stuff like that. But if you just go by the particular folklore, you would have no idea that him, like others, reassessed many of his positions in the same way that many positions that Malcolm, for example, had in 1960 were not the same positions that he had later on in, you know, like 1964. So it had, on a certain level, I'm encouraging people to take that to the whole thing of his whole evolution as a person, and realize that many of the false ideas that he had, especially during the you know, some of the early stages and stuff like that, many of the people who are calling themselves revolutionaries had, but they struggled through it.
True that.
Now, in 1974, Huey wrote this article called Who Makes U.S. Foreign Policy? And what he has to say about that is, quote, "The ideas enshrined in the Declaration of Independence recognize the right of nations to self-determination. Any oppressed people may, in the spirit of the American Revolution, forcibly overthrow the institutions of their oppressor in order to secure for themselves the right of liberty, life liberty, and the pursuit of happiness," quote unquote. "Yet the record shows that the United States has amassed its role of dominant world power. It has consistently oppressed the major social revolutions of our times in violation of the principles of self-determination. The U.S. has intervened militarily, diplomatically, and economically to crush or to cause grave setbacks to these revolutions, whether in Russia, Mexico, China, Cuba, Greece, or Vietnam. Nowhere has this pattern of policy been more evident than with the American intervention in Vietnam. In 1945, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam was established in a document modeled on the American Declaration of Independence. The Republic was at first recognized by the former colonial power, France. But when that power sought to reassert control of its former colonial territory by establishing a puppet regime in Saigon, it found support in U.S. policy. Not only did Washington support France's illegitimate war of conquest through economic and military aid, but Washington itself took over the struggle to defeat the Vietnamese Republic when the French failed. Indeed, more than 20 years after the proclamation of Vietnam's Declaration of Independence, the Vietnamese peasants are still being assaulted by the U.S. armed forces in what must be the most ruthless and destructive intervention on historical record." He goes on and on from there. But my whole point, once again, is to point out that when you listen to what he was saying that we were playing for you in 68, you see that his overall concept started to crystallize even more so as a human trying to struggle and deal with these particular issues. Unfortunately, with the smashing of the Panthers, the demoralization of many of the cadres, that journey was not completed. But in the tradition of those who sacrificed so much on slave revolt and other places, it will be.
Well, I have to basically agree with what Tracy just said. You know, even insofar as I may find it necessary to diverge from Huey's ideas here or there, it is never in a spirit of disrespect. Because if you stop and think about it, people died in that struggle. And when we struggle to clarify issues, challenge some, what have you, it is because we don't want those people to die in vain.
It's basically like what's going on in Iraq now. When I criticized the insurgents and had a critical eye on the fact that there's not any kind of emphasis on developing any kind of future idea, program, platform of what the insurgents want outside of, you know, the U.S. Get Out, that outlines the rights of women, the rights of the masses of people, that the imperialist order, after being defeated, should be paying reparations to them on health care and things of that nature is not because I don't want the forces of imperial policy and military engagement to be defeated, but it's because we want, or I want, the struggle to develop and mature in the same way that when Che and Fidel in the Sierra Mountains started to get a foothold in the mountains during their guerrilla struggle, one of the first things they did was to start to set up a radio broadcast and a printing press so that they could outline their vision of what they wanted Cuba, their agrarian reform and things like that. That's part of the developing progress you have to go through when you're engaged in this struggle, so you don't have, in part, your enemy one define you, and the masses just think you're just out there just shooting away and things of that particular nature, or that those who are engaged in the surge stay stagnant, and all they know is they want women to wear the hijab. And they and they want the insurgents out. Well, if the insurgents out get out and Chalabi's in, is that real freedom? If the imperial grip and the bases are still there and the economic order is still stabilized within the capital market system? So when dealing with these types of issues, amongst other, it's just to help push along what is needed for our overall emancipation. Hold on a second. Just gonna about wrap it up, the slave tonight. Just like it's clear that developing revolutionaries' worldview is much broader than our enemies would have one believe. Our legacy, and in the end, our victory is gonna be much broader than many people would have one believe. But during that time, we will willingly go through a lot of sorrow, tears, and blood. Until the next time, slave revolt.